Boats, stores, and camp equipment had to be conveyed across a working pressure ridge. The movement of the ice was so slow that it did not interfere much with our short trek, but the weight of the ridge had caused the floes to sink on either side, and there were pools of water there. A pioneer party with picks and shovels had to build a snow causeway before we could get all our possessions across. By 8 p.m., the camp had been pitched again. We had 2 pole tents and 3 hoop tents. I took charge of the small pole tent number 1 with Hudson, Hurley, and James as companions. Wild had the small hoop tent number 2 with Wordy, McNeish, and McElroy. These hoop tents are very easily shifted and set up. The 8 forward hands had the large hoop tent, number 3, Crean had charge of number 4 hoop tent with Hussey, Marston and Cheatham, and Worsley had the other pole tent, number 5, with Greenstreet, Lees, Clark, Carr, Rickinson, Macklin and Blackborough, the last named being the youngest of the forward hands. Tonight the temperature has dropped to minus 16 degrees Fahrenheit, and most of the men are cold and uncomfortable. After the tents had been pitched, I mustered all hands and explained the position to them briefly and, I hope, clearly. I have told them the distance to the barrier and the distance to Paulet Island, and have stated that I propose to try to march with equipment across the ice in the direction of Paulet Island. I thank the men for the steadiness and good morale they have shown in these trying circumstances, and told them I had no doubt that, provided they continued to work their utmost and to trust me, we will all reach safety in the end. Then we had supper, which the cook had prepared at the big blubber stove, and after a watch had been set, all hands except the watch turned in. For myself, I could not sleep. The destruction and abandonment of the ship was no sudden shock. The disaster had been looming ahead for many months, and I had studied my plans for all contingencies 100 times. But the thoughts that came to me as I walked up and down in the darkness were not particularly cheerful. The task now was to secure the safety of the party, and to that I must bend my energies and mental power and apply every bit of knowledge that experience of the Antarctic had given me. The task was likely to be long and strenuous, and an ordered mind and a clear program were essential if we were to come through without loss of life. A man must shape himself to a new mark directly the old one goes to ground. At midnight I was pacing the ice, listening to the grinding flow and to the groans and crashes that told of the death agony of the Endurance, when I noticed suddenly a crack running across our floe right through the camp. The alarm whistle brought all hands tumbling out, and we moved the tents and stores lying on what was now the smaller portion of the floe to the larger portion. Nothing more could be done at that moment, and the men turned in again, but there was little sleep. Each time I came to the end of my beat on the floe, I could just see in the darkness the uprearing piles of pressure ice which toppled over and narrowed still further the little floating island we occupied. I did not notice at the time that my tent, which had been on the wrong side of the crack, had not been erected again. Hudson and James had managed to squeeze themselves into other tents, and Hurley had wrapped himself in the canvas of number 1 tent. I discovered this about 5 a.m., All night long the electric light gleamed from the stern of the dying Endurance. Hussey had left this light switched on when he took a last observation, and, like a lamp in a cottage window, it braved the night until in the early morning the Endurance received a particularly violent squeeze. There was a sound of rending beams and the light disappeared. The connection had been cut. Morning came in chill and cheerless. All hands were stiff and weary after their first disturbed night on the floe. Just at daybreak I went over to the Endurance with Wild and Hurley in order to retrieve some tins of petrol that could be used to boil up milk for the rest of the men. The ship presented a painful spectacle of chaos and wreck. The jib boom and bowsprit had snapped off during the night and now lay at right angles to the ship, with the chains, martingale and bobstay dragging them as the vessel quivered and moved in the grinding pack. The ice had driven over the forecastle and she was well down by the head. We secured 2 tins of petrol with some difficulty and postponed the further examination of the ship until after breakfast. Jumping across cracks with the tins, we soon reached camp and built a fireplace out of the triangular watertight tanks we had ripped from the lifeboat. This we had done in order to make more room. Then we pierced a petrol tin in 6 places with an ice axe and set fire to it. The petrol blazed fiercely under the 5-gallon drum we used as a cooker, and the hot milk was ready in quick time. Then we three ministering angels went round the tents with the life-giving drink, and were surprised and a trifle chagrined at the matter-of-fact manner in which some of the men accepted this contribution to their comfort. They did not quite understand what work we had done for them in the early dawn, and I heard Wilde say, "If any of you gentlemen would like your boots clean, just put them outside." This was his gentle way of reminding them that a little thanks will go a long way on such occasions. The cook prepared breakfast, which consisted of biscuit and hoosh, at 8 a.m., and I then went over to the Endurance again and made a fuller examination of the wreck. Only six of the cabins had not been pierced by floes and blocks of ice. Every one of the starboard cabins had been crushed. The whole of the after part of the ship had been crushed concertina fashion. The forecastle and the Ritz were submerged, and the wardroom was three-quarters full of ice. The starboard side of the wardroom had come away. The motor engine forward had been driven through the galley. Petrol cases that had been stacked on the foredeck had been driven by the flow through the wall into the wardroom and had carried before them a large picture. Curiously enough, the glass of this picture had not been cracked, whereas in the immediate neighbourhood I saw heavy iron davits that had been twisted and bent like the ironwork of a wrecked train. The ship was being crushed remorselessly. Under a dull, overcast sky, I returned to camp and examined our situation. The floe occupied by the camp was still subject to pressure, and I thought it wise to move to a larger and apparently stronger floe about 200 yards away, off the starboard bow of the ship. This camp was to become known as Dump Camp, owing to the amount of stuff that was thrown away there. We could not afford to carry unnecessary gear, and a drastic sorting of equipment took place. I decided to issue a complete new set of Burberrys and underclothing to each man, and also a supply of new socks. The camp was transferred to the larger floe quickly, and I began there to direct the preparations for the long journey across the floes to Paulet Island or Snow Hill. Hurley, meanwhile, had rigged his kinematograph camera and was getting pictures of the Endurance in her death throes. While he was engaged thus, the ice, driving against the standing rigging and the fore, main and mizzen masts, snapped the shrouds. The foretop and t'gallant mast came down with a run and hung in wreckage on the foremast, with the foreyard vertical. The mainmast followed immediately, snapping off about 10 feet above the main deck. The crow's nest fell within 10 feet of where Hurley stood turning the handle of his camera, but he did not stop the machine, and so secured a unique, though sad, picture. The issue of clothing was quickly accomplished. Sleeping bags were required also. We had 18 fur bags, and it was necessary, therefore, to issue 10 of the Jaeger woolen bags in order to provide for the 28 men of the party. The woolen bags were lighter and less warm than the reindeer bags, and so each man who received one of them was allowed also a reindeer skin to lie upon. It seemed fair to distribute the fur bags by lot, but some of us older hands did not join in the lottery. We thought we could do quite as well with the Jaegers as with the furs. With quick dispatch the clothing was apportioned, and then we turned one of the boats on its side and supported it with two broken oars to make a lee for the galley. The cook got the blubber stove going, and a little later, when I was sitting round the corner of the stove, I heard one man say, "Cook, I like my tea strong." Another joined in, "Cook, I like mine weak." It was pleasant to know that their minds were untroubled, but I thought the time opportune to mention that the tea would be the same for all hands, and that we would be fortunate if, 2 months later, we had any tea at all. It occurred to me at the time that the incident had psychological interest. Here were men, their home crushed, the camp pitched on the unstable floes, and their chance of reaching safety apparently remote, calmly attending to the details of existence, and giving their attention to such trifles as the strength of a brew of tea. During the afternoon the work continued. Every now and then we heard a noise like heavy guns or distant thunder, caused by the floes grinding together. The pressure caused by the congestion in this area of the pack is producing a scene of absolute chaos. The floes grind stupendously, throw up great ridges, and shatter one another mercilessly. The ridges, or hedgerows, marking the pressure lines that border the fast-diminishing pieces of smooth floe ice, are enormous. The ice moves majestically, irresistibly. Human effort is not futile, but man fights against the giant forces of nature in a spirit of humility. One has a sense of dependence on the higher power. Today, two seals, a Weddell and a Crab-eater, came close to the camp and were shot. Four others were chased back into the water, for their presence disturbed the dog teams, and this meant floggings and trouble with the harness. The arrangement of the tents has been completed and their internal management settled. Each tent has a mess orderly, the duty being taken in turn on an alphabetical rota. The orderly takes the hoosh pots of his tent to the galley, gets all the hoosh he is allowed, and, after the meal, cleans the vessels with snow and stores them in sledge or boat, ready for a possible move.